Come down to the little garden with me. Come go with me. Come go and see.
From Alhambra to Pomona, you're listening to SGV Weekly. This is your fix of the 626, and I'm your host, Chris Greenspawn.
Are you still the same?
This week, our guest is the newest commissioner for the Los Angeles County Homeless Services Authority, Alhambra City Council member Sasha Renee Perez.
Alhambra's identity is definitely wrapped in being a gateway city, right? We're the first city coming out of the city of Los Angeles. So like, if it's something that's impacting the city of LA, it's going to end up impacting Alhambra just because we share a border.
Like the homelessness crisis. She was appointed to the LASA Commission by County Supervisor Ilda Solis because she has a personal connection to the issue.
She has a family member that has actually lived through homelessness, and she's shared that story publicly with many people. So I look to her as one of our future leaders.
Perez sees herself as part of a new wave of progressive millennial politicians that are slowly spilling into the San Gabriel Valley. Can she change our history of NIMBY politics?
Alhambra even has been very conservative for a number of years and just recently began to kind of like chart a new path.
But the situation she's in has gotten a lot messier very quickly. We'll hear what she wants to do about homelessness coming up on SGV Weekly.
Support for SGV Weekly comes from
Dr. Rubin's Pomade.
Dr. Rubin's Pomade is made in Alhambra with a secret recipe since World War II that nourishes your hair with natural ingredients. It comes in flavors like melon, chocolate, and cherry, but please don't eat it. Try their lip balm instead. It lasts for hours. Get yours at drrubinspomade.com and use promo code SGVWeekly at checkout for 15% off. That's drrubinspomade.com.
SGV Weekly, Boom California, and the Daw Center for the Arts present Writing Home, An Evening with Pomona Writers. Acclaimed poet Michael Torres will be there reading poems about P-Town. Jose Vadi will have essays about the whole goddamn state. And Romeo Guzman will be reading about soccer and playing soccer indoors, recklessly. It goes down Sunday, June 12 from 1:30 to 4 at the Daw Center for the Arts in downtown Pomona for free. But hit us up on Insta to RSVP your kids into workshops on poetry, zines, and button making.
Here are a couple things you can do to help us out. Share the show with someone who cares about the San Gabriel Valley. Rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. Follow us at SGV Weekly on Instagram. And consider giving some bucks to our Patreon. You can find it on sgvweekly.com. Now back to the show.
I'm Chris Greenspawn. You're listening to SGV Weekly. Before we get into what's going on with LASA and homelessness policy in the county, let's introduce Sasha Renee Perez, an Alhambra native who was elected mayor of the city at 28 years old.
That was in November of 2020. And the person I defeated at the time was the mayor. And because I defeated him, I immediately became the mayor.
Alhambra has a rotating mayor position, and Perez can cycle into it again in 2024. She's worked in policymaking since she was 18, teaching people of all ages how government works. And she says it's this hands-on part that she loves the most.
Community outreach doesn't end after you get elected to office. Because for me, my joy in doing this work really comes from getting to interact with residents.
And Perez tells us her political philosophy is based in the community, letting their thoughts and opinions drive the discussion.
I just kind of see myself really as like, you know, almost like a facilitator to make those things happen. And here's like their big dream and their big lofty goal. And like, how do I help to get them there?
Okay, that's Sasha Renee Perez. Before we spend 25 minutes hearing what she wants to do on the LASA Commission, here are three important things to note. One, LASA has had a difficult reputation for years. Some people think they're doing their best. Some people think they're not. But it's a countywide entity that has to answer to numerous bosses. Two, LASA's executive director, Heidi Marston, just stepped down, literally 2 days before we taped this interview. In her resignation letter, she said LASA doesn't have the authority or the funding to do its job. And three, about a week after I spoke to Perez, the LA County Board of Supervisors voted to create a new entity to oversee homelessness.
What I see is that it's going to help us unify the work of various county departments and agencies to help us more strategically tackle homelessness.
County Supervisor Ilda Solis, who represents much of the SGV, says LASA will still exist and Sasha Renee Perez will still be part of the commission. We'll hear more from her after the main interview. So as we listen to this conversation with Sasha Renee Perez, keep in mind that a lot is changing, but she still has plenty to say about what could be done for unhoused people living in the San Gabriel Valley. So what will your role on the LASA Commission be?
So my role on the LASA Commission is really to oversee LASA. LASA is the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority. And it is one big job. I cannot emphasize that enough. It feels like in many ways, you know, all eyes are on LASA right now. All eyes are on the homeless situation that's happening here in LA County. You know, the situation has worsened, you know, because of the pandemic. That's very obvious to everyone. And in addition to that, there are a lot of structural changes that need to be made within LASA. There's a lot of governance issues on top of, you know, the services that they're providing, right, and improving upon those services. So there's no shortage of work to do.
Do you not feel that the role is specifically defined?
I would say that it's very hard to give all of the specifics. I mean, because there's such a large number of things to do. In addition to that, in many ways, the role of the commission is up for debate right now, right? There's conversations and, you know, for folks that have been watching, you know, there's this Blue Ribbon Commission report that came out. There's reports that have been done by the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs around how can LASA better improve its services and its structure. And some of that conversation is focused on, should the commission maybe have more authority? Should they have more power? And I don't know, you know, it's all one big question that we're looking at resolving. So the very role of the commission and the duties and responsibilities could very well change even in the next year or so.
What do you think Ilda Solis saw in you that made her want to appoint you to the commission?
That's a great question. I have to tell you, I was utterly shocked when they reached out to me. I have an immense amount of respect for Commissioner Dussault, who is the commissioner that I'm replacing. And I identify with so much of her story and just have admired her from afar for a very long time because, like her, I have also have family that live on the streets currently. I have family that have passed away living on the streets. And Commissioner Dussault has been very open and very public in talking about her situation and her experience of having her brother living out on the streets and how challenging that's been for her and has really given, I think, a human face and a human perspective to the issue. And, you know, to have them contact me and ask me if I'd be willing to fill in for her position, I was honestly just very shocked more than anything. You know, I've been told that, you know, part of the reason why they chose to appoint me is because, you know, I'm a coalition builder. I'm somebody that is very good at working with folks from all different sides. It's a comment that I get from a lot of folks, you know, in and out of politics that I have great relationships with folks from all kind of political identities. And, you know, I put a lot of effort into doing that and into making sure that I'm being very clear with folks all the time, that I'm really maintaining good rapport. And so I think that's a big part of the reason. I think on top of that, too, that, you know, they see me as somebody that's young with a lot of energy that can really bring that to this commission that is just facing a number of issues, and they want somebody that's going to problem solve. And that's something that I'm very good at, is kind of looking at a policy issue and figuring out how to find solutions in a way that's expedient as well.
What do you think are the challenges that the housed public doesn't understand about homelessness?
Oh my gosh.
You can narrow it down to, you know, like 10 or 20.
I think, well, let me just say, I think that there are a number of people the housed public, if you will, as you just referred to it, that do actually sympathize and understand the issue. I think oftentimes, like, the folks that tend to demonize folks that are facing homelessness, they tend to be very loud, and so it feels like they take up all the space in the conversation, but they're actually a very small minority. I think that there's just really a lack of understanding and sympathy a lot of times for what's happening, for the physical, emotional, and mental toll that it takes on someone to be chronically homeless. And, you know, I've seen that within my own family. I've talked with my family members that, you know, have faced that and gone through that, and, you know, have gone through periods of time where I haven't been able to get a hold of my family members because, you know, they were avoiding speaking to me, those that were living on the streets. And, you know, having, you know, I've had one of my cousins tell me before, I didn't want to talk to you because I was embarrassed and I was ashamed. And it's like, you know, to have somebody that you love share something like that with you, it's really painful. And I think that that's a situation that a lot of folks are facing, right? I mean, there's this degree of really challenging mental health issues that folks go through when they are chronically living on the streets. And I don't think that it's something anybody could really understand unless they've been through it. And I think folks that don't get it would really benefit from sitting down and talking to someone who's been through it.
What do you think of the assumption of dangerousness that, again, let's say, well, I don't know that it's a small, loud minority that assumes that unhoused people are dangerous. It seems like a very popular perception.
I don't know that that's the case. And maybe, you know, I also want to, you know, you have to understand, I tend to look at things with rose-colored glasses because I have to, right? I have to maintain some sort of hope, like, in this work that can oftentimes be very, like, soul-sucking and very negative. And so I don't think that. I do think that it's a small minority. I think that, unfortunately, our news and our media has really cast this perspective to make it, to demonize folks that are facing homelessness and to make it seem as though, you know, these folks are inherently violent or that the majority of these folks are violent. And there have been incidences of violence. That is point blank. Yes, that has happened, but that does not represent the majority of cases. There are thousands of folks that are living out on the streets. You know, I just think a lot of it, unfortunately, has just been due to media narratives, right? And what is sexy and what sells when you're doing news? It's blood, it's gore, it's violence. And so, you know, it's kind of like the worst situation. And especially after something like a pandemic where folks have faced some of the worst mental health crises of their lifetimes, you end up with kind of like this perfect storm and this perfect disaster, which is where I think we're at right now.
Okay, so you mentioned that Alhambra being right here on the cusp of Los Angeles sees a lot of spillover of things like homelessness into Alhambra. How do you see rising rents and development around LA's core contributing to that?
Oh, yeah. I think that this is kind of part of the challenge, right? And I was even expressing this. I had my first LASA meeting this past Friday, and I was expressing this to them during our LASA meeting. Is, you know, many of the kind of challenges that create homelessness really start with local city policy, right? And whether that's you know, having eviction moratoriums, whether that's having like rent control, whether that's making sure that affordable housing's being built, like all of that really starts with city government. And if the city of LA is, you know, not doing their part to contribute to some of those things, then we're going to start seeing some of those impacts like happen. We're going to see homelessness begin to rise. You know, I think the city of LA, they did an excellent job with the eviction moratoriums, right, during the pandemic. I think that those things really helped. They also did an excellent job with, and they do have rent control, right? And I think that some of those things are positive, but we're now entering into this period where the moratoriums are ending, right? And state policy has kind of forced and made many of cities' policies basically like ineffective. I'm forgetting what the bill is, but there's a certain bill that was passed up in the state legislature. And unfortunately, it looks like that policy is basically going to wipe out any policy that wasn't passed before a certain time period. I think only like the city of Pasadena is the only one that passed an eviction moratorium that was passed in a time period that allows it to be able to continue to stand. Like even LA County's eviction moratorium won't continue to stand up because of the state policy that was passed. So those things are concerning to me because we know just based off of data that is going to lead to a rise in evictions, which will ultimately lead to a rise in homelessness, which is the last thing that LA needs right now. So it's challenging, right? Because LASA is coming in and what they're really doing is offering services that come at the after part, right? After someone's homeless. But really the part that happens before that, really homelessness prevention really starts with local city government. And, you know, a lot of these, I think we're going to start to see a rise because many of our policies are beginning to phase out.
What's the path to getting Alhambra? Well, these are three things that I think pair together. What's the path to getting Alhambra a just cause eviction ordinance, a rent stabilization ordinance, and an inclusionary housing ordinance?
So we have an IHO already. And that was actually one of the things I worked on before I was elected. So I want to say it was in 2019. I organized with the Everyone In campaign. They're with the United Way. And Grassroots Alhambra and, you know, a number of other community groups for our IHO. And our IHO is 15%. It was passed in 2019, went into effect. I want to say it was maybe like a month or a couple of months later, which would have put it like right at the beginning of 2020. So we do have an IHO. For an RSO, for the Rent Stabilization Ordinance, and for the Just Cause Eviction Ordinance, that is something that, you know, I've been actively working on. It's been challenging, right? Because, number one, I'm the first renter to ever serve on the council. Number two, I'm, you know, being the only person, it's sometimes hard to kind of explain the challenges that one goes through as a renter in this community. Over 60% of our residents are renters, but those folks are not necessarily as civically engaged. And so we don't hear from them as often as we do homeowners in the community. And I think, unfortunately, because of that, it's very hard to kind of capture those perspectives. So it's been an ongoing conversation. And, you know, I've really been pushing on our council to move forward with a just cause eviction ordinance of our own that we can put in place once the county's expires. I'm not sure how that's going to work now with like the new state policy that's passed, because new state policy basically wiped out all just cause eviction ordinances that went into place after, I think it was like September 2021, which is why Pasadena's is the only one that can stand. And then I've also asked the council if we can put aside some funds so that we can hire a consultant to do a rent stabilization ordinance, right? We can bring in the kind of expertise we need to build that out. And, you know, so far it's been a conversation that's been ongoing. It's not something necessarily that I think my colleagues are against. It's just something that my colleagues don't necessarily consider as much a priority right now as I do. And that's, you know, part of the name of the game, right? When you're working in politics and trying to make, you know, a big change like that is, right, is having the patience and also the tenacity to bring people on board so that they'll be willing to, you know, to vote with you and to push for something.
Yeah. And how much of a priority do you consider it right now?
Well, for me, you know, Just Cause Eviction Ordinance is absolutely number one. right? I mean, like, point blank, period. And I have expressed that to them many times. So, and making sure that our residents are informed about what their rights are has been really critical to me, too. There's a number of families that, and, you know, some of them live in my district, some of them don't, that I've been actively keeping up to date on what's happening with the Just Cause Eviction Ordinance for the county, because there is still one in place, and connecting them to services, to legal services, and to legal aid so that they can better navigate their situation. So it's been, you know, it's been a challenging time. And for me, I feel like it's like it's right in my face all the time, because I'm like the only renter. So everyone like comes to me when there's a situation that comes up, you know, related to, you know, their rent being increased dramatically, or them being evicted unlawfully. The assumption is, okay, well, we'll talk to her and she'll know what to do about it. So I think I tend to kind of receive some of this, the feedback and the concerns more frequently than my colleagues do. Mm-hmm.
What direction do you hope that LASA will move towards as it grows out of the period of uncertainty that it's in now, with Heidi Marston stepping down and with the nature of the commission kind of up for discussion?
That's such a big question. I think first and foremost, I mean, as a commissioner, it is a crazy time to be coming onto the commission, right? With Heidi stepping away, it then puts the commission in a role to do probably one of the most important things, you know, possible for LASA, which is selecting like their next leader. And I did not anticipate that I was going to be doing that, you know, when I came on. So that's going to be really critical, to get somebody that is going to be able to lead that commission with compassion, you know, with equity, with care, and that really understands the issue. So I think that that's going to be important, is getting somebody really strong there. Someone that also understands the important role that local cities play, right? That LASA doesn't just service the city of Los Angeles, that there are a huge number of cities throughout the county that need their services as well. So there's that. And then in addition to that, I would say that my goal and my kind of vision for LASA is that the governance structure is much more clear and concise, that that services are being doled out in a timely manner and in an efficient manner, and that folks are, we're seeing more success stories, right? And I think that for me is what's most critical. Right now, there's many challenges that I think are preventing things from moving expediently, whether that's, you know, getting folks that are experiencing homelessness into housing, and just some major delays that are happening. And, you know, to have units, affordable housing units, sitting vacant for months at a time is unacceptable. And, you know, my goal is to make sure that that's not happening any longer. And there's a number of things that need to happen in order for us to make sure systems are working correctly, to make sure that we're getting folks into housing as quickly as possible.
Could you give me one example of one thing that needs to be unlog jammed?
Yeah. So I think one of the things, and it's funny because, you know, I am like learning so much, right, of this in like in real time. It's like a super heavy download that I've had for like the past week on just everything LASA related. But one of the challenges that I've discovered is that many of our departments that we have, right, within the county, many of the housing authorities that are, you know, set up throughout the county, aren't communicating with one another as frequently as they should be.
Home stretch. I'm going to read a excerpt of a poem by the artist Zoe Leonard about elected officials in America that's become pretty popular on social media over the last few years. You've probably seen it on Instagram time and time again. I wonder what you make of it. It has some strong language, so just bear with me.
I want a dyke for president. I want a person with AIDS for president. And I want a fag for vice president. And I want someone with no health insurance. And I want someone who grew up in a place where the earth is so saturated with toxic waste that they didn't have a choice about getting leukemia. I want a president with no air conditioning, a president who has stood in line at the clinic, at the DMV, at the welfare office, and has been unemployed, laid off, sexually harassed, gay bashed, and deported. I want a black woman for president. Do you think this is possible in our system? Is this thinking something you would idealize?
Absolutely. I have actually shared that poem before, so I absolutely love that poem. And I do think that, I believe that that's where we're headed. And I do believe that eventually that we will have a president that has had the kind of life experience, right, that I think we don't typically see in elected leaders, but we need in elected leaders. I think it's funny because when I first ran for office, right, I mean, it was maybe about a year and a half after my cousin had, like, passed away. And I remember being so scared to talk about, like, the subject because it made me not just uncomfortable because it was such a difficult thing for me to process, but it made me very emotional. So sometimes I would cry. And I remember the first time I ever talked about it at one of my first kind of, you know, panels as a candidate, I did end up getting emotional and I was so embarrassed. And after I was done, you know, I had folks come up to me and tell me how much they appreciated, you know, me sharing my experience and me being so honest. And, you know, I realized in that moment something that I had always known but never thought about applying to myself, which is that, you know, sometimes our most challenging moments and some of the darkest times that we've gone through are actually the very things that make us like the people that need to be elected. And it's, you know, the fact that, you know, I know and have seen what it is like to have somebody you love, you know, live out on the streets. It's the fact that I've been through these challenges, that I'm a survivor of sexual assault. It's the fact that, you know, I've witnessed and seen like domestic violence, like all of those things make me a better elected leader. And I don't think that those are necessarily values that we think of when we think about someone's like electability, but you know, the fact that we've unfortunately elected folks that haven't had those experiences, I think, are what have got us into the problems that we have now. And so I believe that people are beginning to realize that, and I think over time you're going to start to see like a shift. And I tell folks all the time, especially when people come up to me and share with me, you know, their personal stories of challenge and of survival, it's like, you should run for office, because what you felt like when you heard me share that, like somebody else is going to feel that when you share your story. So
I didn't come to interview with the intention to dig too much into it, but do you want to share an overview of what your cousin went through?
Yeah, I mean, I'm totally open to talking about it. I would say maybe about 2 years before I ran for office, you know, my cousin and both my cousins and my aunt had been living out on the streets for over 10 years. And so I wanted to find them because I had not been able to find them in a very long time. They lived out in Las Vegas, Nevada, in Clark County, and I went searching for them and was not able to find them. And it was, you know, it was very challenging and difficult. You know, I went to some of the places that they previously had lived, and, you know, it was very hard. And so a couple of months later, I want to say that may have been sometime in April, actually, ironically. And, you know, later on, I had gotten a call from the Clark County's coroner's office telling me that they had found my cousin's body, and they were asking if I could come in and identify his body. So it's, it was a difficult moment for me and like my family, and it haunted me for a very long time. I just, you know, I couldn't sleep for a very long time. I was just having a lot of trouble dealing with it, as was the rest of my family. And, you know, I just felt so angry because I had done all of this work focused on equity and community service and organizing. And then like this thing happened to my cousin, and I just felt like it was so unfair, you know? And I felt a lot of guilt too, just dealing with the fact that this had happened, and like, here I was doing all this stuff out here, like in you know, California, and wasn't able to help him. But realized over time that although, you know, I couldn't do anything to save my cousin, like I could do a lot of good work here to help people like him and, you know, to help families like mine and make sure that we were okay and make sure that people like him were okay. And so that's really where the focus of my work has been, and really what drives not my, just my service on the council, but my service on the LASA Commission and everywhere else I go.
Councilmember Perez, thank you so much for coming on SGV Weekly.
Yeah, thank you, Chris.
As I said earlier, a week after this interview, LA County's Board of Supervisors announced that a new entity would oversee homelessness in LA. So now let's listen to a short interview with Supervisor Ilda Solis about what's to come for LASA, the new entity, and Sasha Renee Perez.
What do you envision for the new group's powers?
Well, what I see is that it's going to help us unify the work of various county departments and agencies to help us more strategically tackle homelessness. But one of the things I know is that we really need to have more transparency and really a more effective response to homelessness. And that fully incorporates mainstreaming the system so that we all know where we're going and we're all in line. I think one of the things we heard loud and clear is that we need to focus on prevention. We need to focus on rehousing and housing acquisition, accountability. And especially when it comes to timely contracting and payments to our providers. And we need to make sure that we're really coupling access to healthcare and access to urgent services. So I'm really hoping that we can focus in on improving the service delivery and making sure that we have 24/7 outreach housing services available, including on the weekends, which I've heard really needs to be improved. And that there hopefully will be a single point of contact, maybe a phone number where people can actually generally get all the information that they need and get it in an appropriate manner, whatever language you speak or what have you, but to continue to provide services well beyond also just the city of LA, but also the other cities in the county that we represent. So that includes all the other 87 cities. And that for me was very important. I've been fighting on this issue now for the past, I want to say maybe 3 years.
Generally speaking, what does the process of this entity taking over for LASA look like? What needs to happen?
I think, you know, what's going to happen is that LASA should really be doing what LASA does best, and that is making sure that people get the services, the funding that they are, you know, should be providing to the different providers, making sure that the contracting is done well and expedited, and making sure also that we are getting those vouchers out appropriately and that we are tracking the metrics data. And I think that's been something that hasn't really been of great focus. And I think that, you know, personally speaking, LASA has done as best as they could, but I do think they may have, how could I say, not been prepared for this particular growth that had to occur in the last few years while they've also been tasked with implementing Measure H. And I don't know that they had the appropriate staff available to do all of that and have all the metrics involved in terms of tracking money, data collection, and making sure that they had sufficient administrative staff to expedite contracting. They hired up a lot of people, no doubt. I think we're going to have to still resolve that because I don't think that they necessarily have to do all of the outreach. I think in certain places they should, And I'm sure that's going to be discussed further. For example, I represent a large portion of the unincorporated areas in East LA, Roland Heights now, and Hacienda Heights, and big places where maybe homelessness may not be as acute in the farther outer eastern parts of my district, but I do know that there are unincorporated communities that do need assistance out there, whether it's making sure that we get medical, mental health, substance abuse treatment, and that we really try to coordinate when people ask us if there are any vouchers available because there's a family that now is finding themselves homeless, that we really do a better job of making that connection and having our local cities sometimes involved or the local level people that are more experienced. I think that can help to expedite the process. And I know many of our cities want to do that, and they've been starting to take on that role, especially out in cities like El Monte, Montebello, Baldwin Park. We've also been able to set aside funding for cities to their COGS through motions and initiatives that I put forward. But I'd much rather see this entity take that over than having a board office having to tell the homeless initiative or to tell LASA this is what they should be doing.
So will LASA then continue to function but under a subsidiary with other groups underneath this new entity?
I think LASA will still have their, you know, they'll still be charged with doing what by law they need to be doing. I don't see that being de minimis, but I do think it should be an opportunity for some of our departments to weigh in, because some of our departments are also get money for Measure H, and they also provide money for mental health assistance. They also provide assistance for transitional age youth. Many of our departments do that. If we can get a better handle on all that, I think it helps us streamline the process and also allows us to be more targeted and more nimble. And I think those are things that the report really pushed out. So I'm hoping that that will happen. And I do believe it will. I think there's support out in the field for that.
I'm curious, what was it about Council Member Sasha Renee Perez of Alhambra that inspired you to appoint her to the LASA Commission? And do you envision a role for her in the transitional growth of this new entity as well?
Absolutely. I mean, she has a family member that has actually lived through homelessness, and she's shared that story publicly with many people. And I find her very engaging and also taking a leadership role in her own city, Alhambra, which is a large city. And there are many cities that have, as you may know, resisted trying to help out during the pandemic with the homeless issue during COVID and all of that. And she was very outspoken and very supportive of some of the things that align very well with not just LASA, but with the county and with many of my efforts. So I look to her as one of our future leaders, not only on this issue, but also helping to educate the other members of our what we call COG, the Council of Governments. It represents parts of the San Gabriel Valley, but other COGs in the Gateway area too, just by the sheer fact that someone wants to spend time on this issue and understands it and can give their own personal experience as well as the authority she brings as a city councilwoman. I think those are all good things to preserve and to continue to support her. So I do not see her role ending in any way. I think it's going to blossom.
All right, Supervisor Yolda Solis, thanks for stopping by on SGV Weekly.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it. And we need to grow this. It really does take a village. Come down to
the Willow Garden with me. County Supervisor Yolda Solis speaking with us last week. Our theme song is Carry Home by the Gun Club, courtesy of Manifesto Records. Ambient music by Kevin Greenspan. Logo design by Felipe Flores and Rita Greenspan. I'm Chris Greenspan. This is SGV Weekly. So carry home. I have returned through so many highways and so many tears.